Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How lasting are the effects of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill? 4 years after the explosion that killed 11 rig workers and touched off the largest oil leak in history, offshore drilling has resumed and even surpassed 2010 levels. But people in affected Gulf Coast communities who earn their livings from fishing, shrimping, and tourism have had a tougher time returning to their old lives, as have survivors of the catastrophe and loved ones of those who didn't make it. Despite promises made by BP to pour money into cleanup and restitution, my guest has discovered that so many damage claims have been declined that in some places, people affected have not even pursued compensation. Filmmaker Margaret Brown directed the documentary The Great Invisible. It will be screened Sunday night at 8 as part of the Lone Star Film Festival in Sundance Square in Fort Worth. Margaret, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
The Deepwater Horizon spill clearly is rich fodder for a documentary investigation in any case, but for you, this story also has a personal dimension.
Right. I'm from Alabama, and the spill affected me really personally. It affected my family's home. I got involved because my father started sending me pictures over the internet of our house, and our house is on the water, and it was surrounded by the orange boom that the volunteer fire department had put out in the water to prevent the oil that was at the surface from reaching the beach and up into the marsh. And there were lots of workers in the photos, and it just sort of seemed like a alien invasion into where I grew up. So yeah, it was very personal.
Early in the film, we meet a guy named Doug Brown, who we should say is not a relative of yours.
No.
But he was chief mechanic on the Deepwater Horizon, and he was at one time so proud of the rig that he quite literally talks about it like it's his baby.
Yeah, he was. The rig was built in Korea, and he was there from the moment it was built, and he knew every nook and cranny of the rig and was really proud of this job. I mean, the Deepwater Horizon was a very technical, advanced rig, and the people who got the jobs on that particular rig were really proud to be on that one.
In terms of technology, descriptions of the Deepwater Horizon bore a chilling resemblance to the things that people used to say about Titanic before either of those craft had their disasters. This was state-of-the-art technology, allegedly designed to be almost failure-proof.
Yes, I mean, I think before this accident, the people on that rig wouldn't have thought about it in the same way. I mean, again, these are the people who got chosen to be on that particular rig were some of the best workers offshore. So they thought they were in good hands.
As Brown explains in the film, though, eventually the crew started being pressured to cut expenses, meaning to cut some jobs, which was okay at first. But then once things weren't brand new, problems began to surface.
Yes. Doug actually had complained at one point, which he testified about to Congress, that they were cutting so many jobs that it was affecting the work. And his complaints just got met with silence. I mean, nothing was done. So he did speak up and say something, and nothing was done at the time.
Let's listen here to another worker, Stephen Stone, who also had concerns that revenue mattered more than safety.
I never had anybody say, oh, you can't go get a drink of water. But there's definitely, you say, hey, I'm going in to get something to drink because I think I'm getting dehydrated. There's going to be ramifications for that. I've, had them tell me not to use safety as a crutch. The senior tool pusher told me that. And I told him, I said, well, we're out here for 12 hours, and it's 100-some degrees outside. I was like, there's got to be a certain pace you have to assign yourself to make it through the day safely.
That was Stephen Stone, a worker on the Deepwater Horizon rig. He was there. Stephen Stone was there the day that the rig exploded?
Yes, he was on the rig.
Hmm. Can you talk about the amount of oil that eventually leached into the Gulf of Mexico and how that affected plans for additional drilling in the region?
Well, it was 176 million gallons of oil a day. And your question was, how much did it affect drilling in the region when that happened?
Initially. Mm-hmm. Because there was a moratorium.
There was a moratorium on drilling. And, you know, a lot of people lost their jobs after the spill, and they were afraid. They didn't know when the moratorium would end, when they were going to get them back. So it wasn't just the fishing industry and the tourism that was affected. It was also the oil industry at first, which was affected.
Well, and this is something that's so interesting about your film, because, you know, there are no easy answers here. The reality is that those petroleum industry jobs are also important, and people aren't quite sure what to do with that fact.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that's interesting in the South that there's actually a festival in Morgan City, Louisiana, called the Shrimp and Petroleum Festival, which is looked at as a harvest festival, thinking like we're harvesting oil from the ocean in the same way that we're harvesting seafood. So people in the South, I think, more before the spill, thought about this in the same breath, you know, like a lot of jobs are dependent on both things, and they weren't seen as necessarily at odds until after the spill.
Hmm. So a lot of the people who were working in this part of the country are independent contractors, meaning they're not in a position to absorb a period of months without work. Can you talk about the situations for some of these Gulf Coast communities that are made up of these independent contractors?
Do you mean in the oil industry or the fishing or just all of it?
Well, talk about everything if you would.
Okay. Well, again, like some people in the South work offshore part of the year and some people work in the fishing industry. That's not unusual. And we talked to a lot of families about that. You know, it was seasonal. And I think, you know, it's different. Like growing up in Alabama, you're used to hurricanes. You're used to natural disasters. But we're not used to these man-made disasters where there's so much uncertainty about what's going to happen next. And I think in the days after the spill, people were just worried kind of that any of it would recover. And the oil industry has recovered. I mean, the moratorium ended. You know, things are back to normal, even better for the industry, I think, in the Gulf. They're drilling in deeper, deeper waters. But the fishing industry has not been so lucky. There's definitely, particularly with oysters, that's going to be a super long recovery. And, you know, it's the same thing. Fishing is still down as well. So, you know, at the beginning, you know, there was uncertainty for both, but the way it shook out was much better for the oil industry.
If there is a bright spot in this film, it's the presence of this remarkable community advocate and volunteer named Roosevelt Harris. First of all, tell us about the community that he's from.
Roosevelt's from Bile Battery, Alabama, which is the fishing community in Alabama. It's about 23 miles from Mobile, which is where I grew up. And, you know, it's a community that's just completely based on the seafood industry. There's a little bit of construction at the dock, actually, that services the oil industry as well, but it's primarily fishing and primarily seafood and packaging. And he, in the days after the spill, brought and continues to bring food and clothing to people in the community who lost their jobs from the spill. And also, I should say that, like, it's also an area that was really affected by Katrina. But again, like, the residents in the area, they knew how to deal with Katrina better than they did with the spill. And they're still kind of, it was a bit like a 1-2 punch, but they're still reeling from both.
I have to admit, the film really challenged some of my ignorant assumptions about the Deep South. We should say that Roosevelt Harris is Black. Many of the people he serves are white. But as we see them in this film, they seem to just genuinely see one another as neighbors rather than people who are, like, divided along racial lines.
That was extremely interesting to me and my crew as well, because I had made another film about 2 years beforehand in the same area called The Order of Myths, which was basically about Mardi Gras in Alabama, which is segregated by race and class, mostly by race. There's a Black Mardi Gras and a white Mardi Gras. And there's some body language in the film where people say that things are equal and things are, you know, we're all together, but you see the way that the body language is between the white and the Black communities, and the camera sees that they're really separate, you know? But then when we started filming The Great Invisible, the crew just remarked that there wasn't the same separation. You know, there's also a Southeast Asian community in Bile Battery as well. And with, you know, Black, white, Asian, it was almost as you didn't, the way people related to each other, there wasn't the separation. It was extremely interesting. And you're right, like what you're speaking of, what you saw in the film was something the crew talked about all the time, the way that people just acted like a community and not, they didn't, it didn't feel separate by race at all. It was remarkable.
There was one scene where Roosevelt Harris is about to bring a box of food to a home, and I don't mean to laugh, but there's a Confederate flag out front. But he was gonna go to the door, but there was a dog barking, and he was like, "I'm not gonna mess with that, you know, angry dog." But I just was so touched that he was willing to overlook this, you know, really offensive thing to still try to extend a hand to a neighbor.
I mean, I remember being in the truck when that happened and wondering what was going to happen. But I think it goes back exactly to what you said, which is that it's a community and people look out for each other. And I think from what we saw, because there's so much poverty in the area and because people have had to act as a community, people really look out for each other. You know, people, instead of sometimes paying for things, people barter what they have. And it's definitely, I don't know. I mean, I really think he was not thinking about the Confederate flag. I really do think he was thinking about the dog, like he says. So, yeah.
So another thing he's trying to do is to encourage people to file these claims, saying, I have suffered damage either directly as a result of, you know, oil on my property, or I have suffered damage to my livelihood. But we see one scene in which he's all set up to meet with a BP official so he can help people discuss compensation and file these claims. Nobody shows up. What gives?
Well, it's actually not a BP official. It's a lawyer who's helping people file claims.
Oh, thank you for the clarification.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah, I mean, this lawyer came down to the region and he was offering to meet with people. I should say this is about probably 3 years in. So I think by then, a lot of people had not gotten claims in the area. I mean, the claims are really hard to fill out. And in the beginning, Ken Feinberg, who was administering the claims, told people in these town meetings, you don't need a lawyer, just deal with us directly. And a lot of people in that area also just don't trust lawyers. I remember there were rumors floating around that the lawyer would take 75% of, people would ask me, Is the lawyer going to take all the money if I file with a lawyer? There was just people in that area don't normally deal with lawyers. And I think BP came in a lot on their own terms and wasn't thinking, well, we did this to this region. You know, we're going to a little bit think, like, how does this region work and how can we deal with them on their own terms? Instead, they came in, you know, with rules that really didn't take into account the way of life there. And I mean, I can see where they're coming from, too. I mean, of course, people should file their taxes and, you know, there has to be some kind of like file or way to fill things out. But there were problems such as that. I remember in Bylabatri, there wasn't even a third of the population in Bylabatri is Southeast Asian. And there weren't translators for the people at the claim center. Outside groups had to come in and try to help people fill out the claims because there wasn't someone there who could speak to them in their language and help them fill out the claim.
So there might be people who were also intimidated by the process, and then it wasn't understandable to them because of the language problem.
That, and also, I mean, I should say that it's a little bit extends beyond the Deepwater Horizon and the claims process, which I think wasn't really set up for the region and wasn't taking them into account. I also think there's like a cycle of poverty in that area where people just don't trust the government is going to help them because they never have. They don't trust that, you know, that BP is going to help them. So, and also a lot of them just don't have cars to get there. Mm. So I think all these things are contributing to just, I mean, there's a sense of hopelessness and not getting aid. And that, I think that's a lot what was going on.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Margaret Brown. She directed the documentary The Great Invisible, which will screen Sunday as part of the Lone Star Film Festival in Sundance Square in Fort Worth. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with director Margaret Brown. Her documentary, The Great Invisible, will screen Sunday evening at 8 as part of the Lone Star Film Festival in Sundance Square in Fort Worth. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Margaret, I want to go back to talking just a bit about Kenneth Feinberg, who is the administrator who was hired by BP to process these claims and sort of manage this. He's been on this show before talking about some of this work and the work he had done after 9/11. Let's listen here to what he had to say to a group of people who were trying to decide how to manage their own damage claims.
If you think this is a trick, you can go file a lawsuit. But my friends, I'm telling you, you'll litigate for years. You may not win. You got to pay a lawyer. I suggest to you that the program I am setting up is absolutely the way to go. Take the money. It's a gift.
Kenneth Feinberg there as featured in Margaret Brown's documentary, The Great Invisible. Margaret, when I hear that, I mean, it sounds really tone deaf, right? It's a gift. It's hard to look at it as a gift if people are just looking to get back what they have lost.
Right. I mean, I met Ken Feinberg. I interviewed him. I thought he was a lovely person. But it you know, you watch that footage and you're like, what is this message? Because it's not a gift for this oil to ruin these people's livelihood. And when you see the footage, just the looks on their faces when he's saying that, I mean, I don't think they think they're receiving a gift.
Was it a mistake to hire Feinberg? Is it just simply that he doesn't know the community and how things work in that part of the South?
Well, Kenneth Feinberg is someone who's always been hired to deal with these kind of disasters. You know, and I think he's sort of the go-to guy. I do wonder if it might have been better to get someone who was Southern or who was used to the region. But, I mean, I understand why he was the go-to guy. I think that, you know, and also one man can't do this. It's a huge job. I mean, he was in charge, but it would take a lot of muscle. I think he's the spokesperson for it. But I do think he thought he could go in and fix this problem that was just too big for him to handle. And in the film, he says, one of the few people in the films who says, I made a mistake. I couldn't get people claims as quickly as they wanted. And, you know, I mean, as you know from the film, I mean, some of my characters are still waiting for money. It's not, there's a lot of people in the film who this is dragging on for quite some time.
So it's not unreasonable for even one of these compensation programs to say, look, we need documentation of what you have lost. But the issue, I guess, is that that's one thing to ask of, say, a college-educated small business owner. Things are done differently when a lot of business is conducted more informally.
Exactly. And he even acknowledges, he says someone told him that things are done with a handshake here, which of course you can't document that. But I think there's a middle ground, and the claims just didn't even begin to get to that middle ground and, you know, help the people. What I saw making the film over 4 years is that, you know, like you said, if you have a degree, if you know how to deal with lawyers, a lot of those people seemed a much better chance of getting some money or getting some proper compensation. The people who are, you know, shucking oysters or have a very small seafood business, those kind of places, chances are going out of business or not knowing how to deal with this. But I should also say that many people who do know how to deal with lawyers and who, you know, a lot of people did get compensation, certainly, but a lot of people who were used to this were still having a lot of issues with the claims and having trouble getting money. I also want to say that at a certain point, BP has started contesting some of the money they've already given to people. This isn't in the film, but it's happened since the film was finished editing. BP has started asking are trying to get some of the money back that they'd agreed to pay to people on the system that they administered.
What's the latest on the government case against BP and the fines that might be levied against it?
Well, there was just a case where it was ruled that they would need to pay $18 billion, but BP is appealing that. So again, it's going to go into turnaround, but they were found to be grossly negligent.
Another thing that the film does, and I'm not sure this was, you know, fully your intention, this is not the point of the film, but it's a reminder of how hard people work, like providing the seafood that we eat on a regular basis. You know, shucking oysters is hard work. This is work that kind of breaks down the body, and it's very repetitive. Maybe not something people would do if they had other options.
I mean, exactly. You know, when you're making a film, a lot of times you find out things that you didn't even know about your community. And that was, it was very eye-opening to go into, you know, these small shops where people were working so hard. And this is also a community. Biola Battery is a community where people, you know, most people don't graduate from middle school. It's really a big deal, actually, if you graduate from middle school in the community. And people work really hard from a very young age. And it's been that way for generations. And they're proud of it. So this is something where this hit. And again, it's not like a hurricane, which can wipe a house away, but you know what you're dealing with a hurricane. With this spill, people did not know what to expect. And you know, for a lot of them, they're out of business. And, you know, we've gone back and checked in with people. And, you know, the last time we shot, which was about a year ago, a little bit less than a year ago, people who'd been working 6 days a week, 12-hour days, are now down to, like, 2-day weeks that are like 5-hour days. So it hasn't recovered.
And they're not making $40 an hour. They're not making enough to get by on those hours.
No, they're making like $9 a day, some of them.
Hmm. Some oil industry executives seem to feel the public just doesn't understand how good we have it thanks to technology like offshore drilling. And I'd like to listen here to a clip from the film that is pretty astonishing. This is a group of, maybe you can set it up for us, a group of oil industry executives at an industry conference.
I'm not sure which scene you're talking about.
They're sitting around and smoking cigars, and they are drinking scotch or whiskey, and they are talking about folks not appreciating that oil is cheap and readily available.
That is just a night in Houston. That's not at the offshore trade show.
Okay, let's listen.
Everybody hammers big oil. What is Google? Google earns billions. Yeah, big oil gets the hammer. They get all the bad press, where I think we should be thanking our lucky stars that we should have $4 gas.
I love that you say that. It's just a night in Houston.
Actually, that is from the offshore trade show. I'm sorry.
Okay.
That was a different scene.
They're sitting around speaking very frankly. You're clearly close enough for them to know there's a camera right there. Can you talk about what kind of discussion you had with them, if any, before they agreed to have their conversation filmed?
That conversation, the man who's talking, I knew him, but I didn't know anyone else at that table. That was during OTC in Houston, which is the largest gathering for the oil industry in the world, and we were there filming. And they had just invited us to film their dinner. So I pretty much showed up without knowing anybody with a camera, and we filmed the dinner. But I did know him. And I think there's a conception in the industry that people... I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, after making the film, I definitely thought we're connected to this factory under the Gulf of Mexico. We don't think about it when we fill up our car. And I think they have something there when they're, you know, that we should consider ourselves lucky, because people don't think about the risk that it takes to get what we're using. That's not exactly what he's saying in that clip. But the scene itself and a further scene sort of illustrate that, I believe.
Well, he's got a point, too, when he says, you know, we're lucky that fuel is inexpensive. And I think that, you know, that it sort of goes on from there. Because we as consumers, in many ways, we do want it both ways, right? We want everybody to be safe. We want the environment to be pure. And yet, boy, everybody's celebrating all over social media that gas is $2.65 a gallon right now.
I know it's ironic. I mean, it was interesting when I started making the film. I remember friends of mine would say, Margaret, like, go get BP, you know, go show them. And, you know, about 2 years in, I do think BP has a terrible safety record, and they obviously need to be held accountable. But I also think there is a double standard where we don't think about what we're doing when we fill up our car, and we're not making that connection. And I hope the film makes some of these connections so people do think about the great risk that they're supporting when they fill up their car, don't think about what they're using when you don't carpool, when you drive somewhere where you could walk or bike. I mean, I think the film for me was a big awakening as to like what I can do as opposed to just not thinking about it.
What was the relationship between BP as sort of the company that was wanting to extract this fuel, and then Transoceanic, the company that actually owned, am I right, the rig, the Deepwater Horizon rig?
Yeah, BP was in charge of the job, and it was Transocean's rig. And so the BP company man is in charge of what goes on in the rig, but it's a lot of mostly Transocean workers who are doing the work on the rig.
And which company took responsibility for caring for the employees who were directly affected on the day of the explosion?
Well, it has changed who's been dealing with it. I believe in the beginning, Transocean was handling a lot of it. I don't know exactly. I know that, I know from Doug and Steven that it went back and forth. I think that, I can't remember if it was BP was doing it first and then it switched to Transocean. But I know that they've had to deal with both companies because Doug has had a lot of medical issues from the spill. I mean, he was crushed almost in the explosion, and Transocean is still fighting him for his medical coverage and saying, oh, this operation you need, you know, it's not related to the explosion, when it's, you know, he has to keep proving over and over to keep getting these operations that are clearly and directly related to the explosion.
Let's listen to Doug Brown's memories of the blast itself.
We were in the dark. It was quiet. Nothing. I only had enough time to tell my guys that we're in trouble. Something's wrong, guys. We are in trouble. And then the first explosion hit us. It picked me up and flung me and flipped me through the air like I was nothing but a rag doll. I couldn't move. All I could hear was screaming. Incoherent screamings of pain. Screaming, I'm dying, I'm hurt, somebody help me. Someone crawled screaming over the top of me.
That was Doug Brown describing his memories of the explosion aboard the Deepwater Horizon in 2010. Both Doug Brown and Stephen Stone, who you also feature in the film, both have been left with pretty significant issues with PTSD.
Yes. I mean, in the beginning when I was... They were actually the two hardest people to get to agree to be in the movie. Actually, more Doug than Stephen, but both were... I mean, I think I must have called them both and tried to convince them for close to a year, if not 6 months, just trying to get them to be in the film. Their wives were very concerned that reliving what happened would be worse for them, or would bring back things that, you know, because they both struggle with PTSD. Doug has some pretty unbearable nightmares, you know, about the event. So it took a really long time to convince them to do the interview.
You never were able to convince anybody from BP to do an interview. Is that right?
Well, in the beginning, I thought it was going to be doable. When I was on the ground in Alabama, and there were a lot of local people who were friends with my family growing up that were working for BP and helping, I thought I would be able to get in then. But it never quite, they would say, oh, we'll talk to you next week, or, you know, we'll keep trying to make this happen. But it kind of just always was receding into the distance. And, you know, I tried every which way to Sunday to get BP to talk to me, because, I mean, I was talking to so many people in the oil industry, and in a certain level, the oil industry is small and people know each other. So I did think that I would get them to talk to me, but it just never happened.
Well, it's interesting, because they wouldn't talk to you and they're not in the film. We had the sense that, like, people like Stephen Stone and Doug Brown feel guiltier about this than the oil company they were working for.
I mean, you got to think. I mean, I definitely think, you know, we've been doing Q&As across the country. And I also wanted to say that the film also opens in Dallas this weekend. And I'm doing a Q&A in Dallas. I think it's 7:30 on Saturday night at the Angelica Theater. So it's not just the closing night film at Lone Star. It's also playing in Dallas with a regular theatrical release. But they've been going to... They've been sort of having these moments on stage, which I think is common with PTSD, where you recall things that have been suppressed. And we were in Santa Barbara on Monday, and Doug was on stage, and he started saying some stuff that he hadn't even told me for the film. And I think we were all pretty surprised, but I think it can happen with PTSD. You just recall things, something triggers it, and it brings it up. And you could have heard a pin drop in the room. It was very powerful.
What did he say?
He was going into the details of what happened the night of the explosion, because another man was there, John Conrad, who used to work for Transocean, and he runs a website called G-Captain, which is, it's kind of like Rigzone. It's a website that a lot of people in the oil industry read for their daily news. And in fact, it was the first website to publicize that the Deepwater Horizon had exploded. That's where Mecca Brown read and found out that her husband's rig had an awful accident. So he was kind of contextualizing it for people that Doug had rescued another person on the rig, that he was kind of a hero. He'd saved someone else while he was greatly injured. And I think that triggered for Doug the specifics of how he'd rescued this other man and got him off the rig. And so he was recalling in great detail what had happened. It was very powerful. And I was looking at Sarah, the wife of Stephen, who was on the rig, and we were both like, this is PTSD.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Margaret Brown. She directed the documentary The Great Invisible, which will screen Saturday with a Q&A at the Angelica Theater in Dallas, Sunday as part of the Lone Star Film Festival in Sundance Square in Fort Worth. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Graduate Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for January to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Margaret Brown, the filmmaker who directed the documentary The Great Invisible. It will screen Saturday at the Angelica Theater in Dallas with a Q&A with Margaret Brown. Also, there will be a screening Sunday as part of the Lone Star Film Festival in Sundance Square in Fort Worth. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. One thing we haven't talked about yet, Margaret, is the fact that you have some very, I sort of hate this phrase, but you have exclusive footage in this film of the Deepwater Horizon on an everyday sort of work day that Doug Brown had taken. First of all, why did he take that footage? What was his plan for it?
Well, like we talked about earlier, he was super proud of his job. He had a really good job. And also, people don't know what it's like to work on a rig. You can't go as a civilian out to a rig and see what it's like. It's a secret world that only people who work offshore see. And so people were always asking him what his job was like. And he made a video for his friends and family just to show to them what it was like to work on a rig. And the rig happened to be the Deepwater Horizon about 2 years before the accident. So, you know, when he told me that he had this DVD, you know, I really wanted to watch it to see what was there. And when I did, I just felt like it was, you mentioned before the Titanic analogy. I mean, it really was like looking at something like the Titanic before it sank. We just couldn't believe it when he gave us that footage.
It's so eerie, yeah, because we know what's coming.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's nuts.
You also met, and there are several interviews with the father of a young man who was killed in the explosion, who had been a new father himself. Can you tell us a little bit about him and about sort of his family's attempts to cope with the loss of their son and husband?
Yes, well, Keith Jones is the father of Gordon Jones, who he was one of the 11 that died. And when he died, the day he died, his son was born 2 weeks later. So he was a young father of an infant and also about to have another kid. And he was offshore working extra, you know, to make money for that. And Keith is in the film. He happens to be a lawyer. Gordon was one of the first people in his family to work offshore. His family was not someone who had normally had offshore workers in the family. And so Keith has sort of become part of, you know, the team that's fighting BP legally. And he's the spokesman a lot of the time. And he's spoken out a lot about what happened on the spill, I think, because a lot of the families who, you know, of the 11 that died, they have a lot of family that's worked offshore. And but he doesn't really have, he doesn't have that connection, and he's just mostly grieving for his son and not thinking as much about lifting the moratorium and getting other people back to work, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about what you concluded about whether this could have been prevented, because I think everyone understands that as unfortunate as it is, there are certain professions that carry with them significant risk that might be greater than, you know, working an office job somewhere. Did you come away with the sense that this should never have happened if things had gone the way sort of industry protocols and standard protocols would have prescribed?
You know, I definitely think people working offshore, they know their job is dangerous. I think it takes a certain type of person to want to work offshore. Doug talks in the film about how he knew his job was dangerous, and that's something he liked about it. He liked the thrill of it. He liked being offshore when there was a storm coming and standing on the deck and feeling the wind, you know. I mean, I don't know. I'm kind of an adrenaline junkie. I mean, I get that. But, you know, I think that could it be prevented? I think it's something, there's something to be said for the culture offshore, which I think is really important to mention. Everyone I've spoken with talks about the culture. It's you know, it's a family. There's also kind of a military feel, like you'd get it done. You know, that's the attitude, getting it done in the industry. And I think, you know, and you also do what your supervisor tells you and you don't question. So I think there's a lot of that going on. There's lots of fear from deviating from that. I think something that we can look at now to prevent this is ways that we can promote whistleblower safety offshore. I think that's a huge thing in terms of preventing this from happening again. John Conrad, who I mentioned previously, who is one of the people who runs G-Captain, he considers himself an environmentalist, and he says he's saved more oil spills working offshore. You know, he can stop jobs, or he has. Actually, he got fired by Transocean for stopping a job, so I should mention that as well. But he was a whistleblower, and he has said before, which was interesting to me because it's somewhat counterintuitive, that he thinks that if you want to be an environmentalist, you should work in the oil industry because you will have many opportunities to do something good. You know, you can speak up if something's going wrong, because I don't think that's not appealing to people who want to work for the environment to go work offshore. It's a kind of an, I mean, I think working offshore, I mean, you know, I talk to people, it's like watching Fox News all day, but I think, you know, that's what they watch offshore, I should say. That's not the job. But I think he just speaks like, well, you know, why aren't people who want to be environmentalists going for these jobs? And I think we know the answer, but it's an interesting question.
It's not really in the film, Margaret, but I wonder if you witnessed any division among former colleagues, some of whom maybe accepted temporary contracts with BP to assist in the cleanup efforts and some of whom did not.
former colleagues who worked offshore?
People who, you know, had boats that were drafted into the effort to try and clean things up. And, you know, my understanding is even things like fishing boats and tugboats were called in to help and could make some money that way while there was the moratorium on in particular.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that was a great source of income in the South. Like, people made a ton off the shrimp boats going out and working, you know, to clean up the oil. But as you see in the movie, it was mainly for show. I mean, not all of it, obviously, but the guy in our movie who BP had told him to use his shrimping nets to get the oil. And I mean, clearly, like, shrimping nets are not going to drag for oil and gather oil. And he was just sort of, like rolling his eyes at that right before we got kicked off the boat. Because at that point, BP wasn't letting these fishermen who were hired by BP to do the cleanup to talk to the media, possibly because what they were doing was so ludicrous, as he demonstrates.
Yeah, he basically says, like, the net is full of holes. It's not going to hold oil any better than it does water.
Right.
There is a pretty remarkable scene where someone demonstrates how thick that tarry sludge is that is left all over everything.
Well, that goes to another point, which that's Latham Smith, who does work for the oil industry and did assist with the cleanup. And, you know, he was part of the team that actually did go and drag for oil and get some of it. So, I mean, there were people who were doing it in an effective way as well. I definitely want to point that out. But there was a lot of it that was just for show. So he, you know, brought some back to sort of show me what it looked like what is this stuff that we're all talking about? This is what it looks like.
You have a great scene in the film as well of some school children who are given a Skype connection and they talk with people who lived through the Exxon Valdez spill.
Yeah, well, we were shooting in that community for so long, and there was a class that was it was the anniversary of the Exxon Valdez. I believe it was the 22-year anniversary. And we were invited to come to the class when they Skyped with these two scientists. And the kids were just, you know, they were just wondering. They hear their parents every night at dinner talking about the spill. And, you know, again, it's a fishing community, so almost all of their parents work in that industry. And so they were asking all the questions, you know, to the people who'd experienced this before. And to me, it's a very moving scene because the questions are so smart and they're worried about the community so much, but also because at the end, there's a kid who says, like, the North doesn't understand our problems. And, you know, but we, as a community, we're working together. And as someone from Alabama, but also someone who's lived in New York and L.A. and left, I mean, I still really identify with this kid, you know.
Do you think there's something to the fact that there are cultural differences? You know, where these companies are headquartered is not necessarily the same kind of community where people are directly affected by spills.
Sure. I mean, I think we saw that with the cleanup and that kind of disconnect between the executives talking about oil and the people who are doing the seafood work. I mean, I think you can see that in the movie. Whereas they both have valid points of view, there is a disconnect, a class disconnect for sure. That's, I think, pretty visible in the film.
So how are things now? Several of your subjects are still waiting for compensation and living on just a very small amount of money every month.
Yeah, Stephen and Sarah and Doug and Mecca still haven't gotten any money from BP and Transocean. I should say BP, really. And they're living off kind of, I think, some loans from their lawyers. And just, I mean, there's been times I've said, like, hey, can you come to the Q&A? And they're like, well, we don't have enough money for gas, you know. So, I mean, we help them out with that. But, I mean, I think their concerns right now are super basic. And you forget it because these are people who had really good jobs before the accident. And and then they're sending me an email saying we don't have enough money for gas. And you're like, oh, you know, that's reality for them right now.
Yeah, there's a scene where Doug's wife is like, he made a six-figure salary, and now we wait for these checks, and we're getting, like, less than $1,000 a month. I guess that's maybe disability or something.
Yeah, I mean, Transocean is paying them a very small amount just to kind of keep them. I mean, I don't think Doug is fired. He's sort of still on the payroll, but it's like a ridiculous amount of money for someone who makes over six figures a year and who has these crazy operations that are from the spill.
At the end of the day, what sort of revenue source is offshore drilling for the federal government?
I mean, next to our taxes, it's the second largest revenue source. So it was interesting. Another revelatory thing for me was just seeing how much money our government makes from offshore leases and how deep the government is in bed with the industry. That was, I mean, maybe I'm naive, but it was kind of a shocker.
Did you find any evidence that safety protocols have been tightened on rigs comparable to the Deepwater Horizon?
I mean, nothing, no major legislation has been passed to make it safer. There are a few things that have, I mean, also, like, I should say that because of the spill, I think everyone in the industry is kind of on high alert. You know, I think right now, people are companies are voluntarily doing things to make it safer. But since these aren't things they have to do to make it safer, it's not really, I don't really feel like necessarily we're more protected. I mean, and a blowup preventer fails 40% of the time. And this is supposedly the thing that stops it if there's an accident. So it's just like when we're working, you know, 2 miles down with something that may or may not work, I think we have to kind of look at that and, you know, is that really a safe environment?
Could it happen again?
I mean, yeah. I mean, I think the fact that there's nothing in place that makes it safer, that's mandated, means that it could happen again. I mean, there's 3,500 platforms in the Gulf of Mexico connected to as many as 20 wells each. You know, that's a lot of holes in the ocean floor, you know. And it's not, there's nothing that's making these companies, that's holding their feet to the fire and saying, hey, you have to do this safer since the spill.
Are responses to the film pretty uniform, no matter where you go in the country? Or are there certain things that strike people depending on the region where you're screening it?
Well, we've just started the theatrical rollout, so I can't speak to like the whole country, but I have noticed that in the South, people are a lot more curious about this because it's felt so directly. We just had a sold out screening at a big theater in New Orleans for the festival there about 2 weeks ago. And, you know, it was definitely like a heated discussion after the movie. I think our screenings in Texas are going to be really interesting because of the industry. And we're going to show the film in Alabama in about 2 weeks. And I know that's going to be a really interesting screening. You know, I think people feel how they're connected to the industry in the South in a much more visceral way. But I mean, also, it definitely, like in New York, and it was funny in New York. We've had some former BP workers come to screenings and want to talk. So I mean, I think it's been interesting across the board. But the Southern ones are fun.
Margaret Brown directed the documentary The Great Invisible. It will screen, being followed by a Q&A event at the Angelica Theater in Dallas on Saturday night and at the Lone Star Film Festival in Sundance Square in Fort Worth on Sunday night. Margaret, thank you so much for being with us.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.